Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. How did the United States become the world's biggest black market for stolen artifacts from ancient civilizations? Let's get to the bottom line. Well, if you're in the market for a coffin from the time of the pharaohs in Egypt or gold from the Inca Empire, you've come to the right place. The United States is one of the world's main places for cultural racketeering, which is the illicit trade in ancient art and artifacts. The antiquities trade is a multi-billion dollar industry, and it takes place around the world. In all fairness, the United States isn't alone. The problem runs from Germany to England to China, the Middle East, and beyond. Just last month, France returned 26 works of art to Benin, which had been demanding their return since 1892. That's about 130 years ago. When French colonial soldiers basically stole them and brought them home, that sort of thing is taking place now all over the world, especially in the Arab world. Buyers and sellers are taking advantage of lax regulations, making deals on statues from Yemen or clay from the Babylonians all the time. So how does the trade happen, and what's being done to stop it? Today we're talking to Deborah Lehr, the founder of the Antiquities Coalition, which focuses on protecting cultural heritage around the world, and Amr Al-Azam, professor of Middle East history and anthropology at Shawnee State University in Ohio, and currently a visiting professor at Qatar University. Professor Al-Azam is the co-director of the Antiquities Trafficking and Heritage Anthropology Research Project. It's really great to have you both here. I've always been interested in this subject, as we saw essentially the looting happen and the instability from the Arab Spring and after the wars that have happened in the Middle East. You begin seeing things on Facebook and eBay that you clearly knew were looted from places. And we saw this going on. So, Amr, kind of tell us about the smuggling route. How do artifacts get out of these places? You know, which this is our cultural past, our history. How do they find themselves into the homes of billionaires or into museum collections from the area of the world where you are in right now?
Right. Well, the first thing to say here is that looting of artifacts from, you know, tombs and places, archaeological sites, etc., is as old as humanity itself. As long as people have been burying their dead with goodies, someone's been coming up behind them, digging them up, and then taking them and trying to make a profit from them. So this is not a new phenomenon. This is not specific to a certain time or place or space. That said, often, as we see in times of conflict, in times of instability, and, you know, obviously the region since 2011 has been going through multiple, you know, difficulties, wars, conflicts, etc., we see an increase in this kind of looting and trafficking in antiquities and cultural heritage. Places like Syria, Libya, and Yemen have all and have all suffered extremely. Of course, Iraq, we all know what happened to the museum in Baghdad. All of these places get looted, and these are manifestations of basically the inability and loss of control by law enforcement agencies and the institutions that are intended to protect cultural heritage sites and monuments. And usually the looting is done either by organized trafficking gangs, etc., which is one way this is done. But also we mustn't forget that in many cases it's just average people, everyday people, who just want to make ends meet, and we refer to these as subsistence looters. And between the two of them, you end up with a lot of stuff flooding the market.
Well, Amr, we also saw this from ISIS. We saw this from terror groups. We saw ISIS, which was out either destroying cultural relics, you know, buildings and sites of worship, but taking these antiquities to also help fuel itself. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, certainly, we need to appreciate that groups like ISIS, and ISIS is not exclusive in this, basically see cultural heritage as a resource, and they exploit this resource in a number of different ways. Effectively, in the case of ISIS, they looted what they can sell, and what they could not sell because it was too big or immovable, they then destroyed in these very public sort of manner displays. I refer to these as cultural heritage atrocities, and these were specifically designed to demonstrate the ability of ISIS to act with impunity and the impotence of the international community and local communities to prevent them from doing that. So essentially, ISIS exploited cultural heritage as a resource in the same way that it might exploit mineral wealth or a cotton harvest or any other material or something they can use to enrich themselves and to fund their activities. And, of course, the other big game changer in all of this was the expansion of the internet and social media platforms, which kind of really acted as a game changer from around 2013, 2014 onwards, opening up the market in ways that we could not imagine before.
Well, thank you. Deborah Lehr, you helped found the Antiquities Coalition because you were disturbed by what you saw in the practice, the racketeering, the looting of these incredibly priceless artifacts from it's our collective past. It's all of our collective past from ancient civilization and whatnot. And I'm just interested in what the ecosystem is and how, when you sort of look at it today, and what are the parts of this ecosystem that you feel we can, you know, make an impact on?
Well, one of the things that we're very appreciative of is that the political will is growing in recognition that this is a serious crime and it's a global crime. And as Amr rightly pointed out, some of it, you know, looting has been going on as long as there have been buried treasure. But with the advent of sophisticated technologies like the internet, with express mail, with these online auction houses, now you make this looting essentially in the market for it global. And so you can tap into that. And the conventions that we have, the international laws that we have, predate in many times this new technology. The main one from UNESCO dates from 1970. So we need to create a new, updated legal structure that reflects the modern world.
So what's the limit of that UNESCO framework? What's wrong with it that it's not capturing these digital platforms?
So it doesn't give the ability to even address e-commerce, for example. It doesn't give UNESCO the ability in many ways to be proactive in its nature in times of conflict, to go in and create, for example, a Blue Helmets for Culture. The Italians took the lead in trying to do that through the United Nations in recognition of this crisis with support from Jordan and Iraq. But we still have a ways to go for the international community, in particular UNESCO, to be proactive. What we do have, which I think is very encouraging, is the G20 under Italy's leadership actually took up the issue this year. And they are looking at how we can address through the major markets, which tend to be the demand countries, creating the infrastructure, whether it's through art crime squads and the police, through being creative in how we would use, for example, anti-money laundering laws and other capabilities, raising awareness amongst dealers, collectors, auction houses who are often the sellers of these items, right. To raise awareness to make sure that it's being seen as a serious crime.
Well, you know, one of the fascinating things I've been reading about Amr al-Azam's group, and I'm fascinated by it because it sounds like you have a league of Facebook watchers, you've got a great report out on Facebook, and I myself have seen these artifacts on Facebook and on eBay. And so when you look at it, the digital platforms, the visuals of these things help broaden the market, but they also help, you know, those that are watching kind of see what you're doing. Tell us about this golden sarcophagus at the Met.
Well, that's what you rightly point out. I mean, it's now become this global platform, right? It used to be in the old days you'd walk into a Manhattan showroom. They would only be able to have an inventory of a few items. You would see what you were getting. You would make the purchase. Now you can take a look at it online. And in the case of the Met, they actually, and there's a very famous photo of Kim Kardashian.
This is the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
The Metropolitan
Museum.
The Big Met. And a simple Google search would have identified that of the stamp that was on this full-size golden sarcophagus from Egypt, that it was actually a fake provenance. Just a simple Google search is what was needed. And it was bought from Europe. It had been looted from Egypt after 2011. Beautiful piece that has since been repatriated back to Egypt.
And there was a photo with Kim Kardashian standing in front of it?
Absolutely,
so of course,
from the Met Ball.
Zillions of people saw it, right?
Of course.
Yeah,
yes,
so that's
on her Instagram.
I find that fascinating. And just another one, you know, I find this fascinating that some of the worst culprits in this are in the United States. Michael Steinhardt, a billionaire, very famous in the hedge fund industry, had 180 or more looted items. What's the story there?
And donated to the Met, also a piece that had to be returned, and to many other major museums. And Steinhardt is just one example of many. And this is part of a global network that we need to start to address, starting from the supply countries. And we know in some cases, with the breakdown in civil society, people are looking for how they can survive. We understand. But it's these international gangs that start to get involved, and the mid-level people, the distributors. Mm. And some days in cases with Syria and Iraq, for example, when the worst of the looting was going on in the time of the crisis, much of the antiquities were coming across the Turkish border. And as police were looking to stop them, one day they would be seizing antiquities and humans. Another day it was antiquities and nuclear materials. So the distribution networks tend to be the same with just a variety of products. It then gets to a middleman where it's specialized. Hmm. And these specialists then start to work with experts, whether it's in the case recently of Southeast Asian art, somebody out of Thailand was acting as a middleman for the Khmer Rouge when they needed some money for the Civil War. They would sell a few of the looted antiquities from Cambodia. He worked with a professor here in the U.S., and a very well-known and well-respected dealer in Manhattan who's just pleaded guilty to 3 felony crimes for her complicit work in selling these Southeast Asian antiquities.
Wow, so there's corruption even in the finest salons. Amer, I'm really interested in how, for our audience, we process what are the kinds of appropriate artifacts that are in museums? You know, I've been to the Museum of Art in Philadelphia or the Museums of Natural History, and we see mummies and sarcophagi. We see the Elgin marbles in London. We see, you know, a lot of elements of our collected history in these great museums in the world. How are those different than what you're trying to stop today? Or is it all part of the, you know, the same, you know, the same process of, you know, looting?
Well, I mean, technically, and I say technically, any item in a museum today, whether it's the Metropolitan Museum, whether it's the Louvre in Paris, whether it's the British Museum, Philadelphia, or any of these other museums that you mentioned, technically, any item that doesn't originate in that country or from that country has at some point been looted. Now, the question of legality is another matter altogether, because obviously, you know, whilst the original owners of these artifacts would want to claim them back, and we know that there are numerous countries, and in the case of the Elgin marbles, for example, the Greece has been demanding their return for many, many, many years. But the 1970 UNESCO Convention, which I believe Deborah mentioned earlier on, is kind of the you know, the watershed point where it was decided with the 1970 convention that any item that happened to already be out of its country of origin, irrespective of how it got out, as long as that happened before 1970, then it gets grandfathered in. So everything we work on and we work on today is focused on artifacts, objects, items that are looted or supposed to have originated outside or come outside after 1970. And to make this kind of a little clearer, imagine, if you remember, there was a case in 2019 when Christie's were selling the head from one of, you know, Tutankhamun's tomb. And there was a huge discussion and debate, and the Egyptians were claiming that this was looted and it needed to be returned, and Christie's were saying no, this is legal, we can sell it, and the owners who were Netanyahu, an Italian family, were saying no, we can hold on to this. What was incredible for us is no one was disputing it was looted. Neither the Egyptians, nor the owners, nor Chris. Nobody was saying, no, this was not looted. Mm. Everybody agreed it was looted. And that's what, for me, was incredible. What the argument was about was it was looted before 1970 or after 1970. Okay. So it's okay for it to be looted as long as it's looted before 1970, and it's not okay after. And I think that's part of the problem that we have. Now, there are many ways to address this, I think, and there are ways that are already sort of, in play. One way is to, for example, suggest, one country might put these objects that are already in, say, the Louvre or in the Met or elsewhere on a long-term loan or permanent loan, but the original ownership would be, given back to the country of origin. There are ways of making this right without just emptying out all our museums. But there needs to be a recognition that there was a fundamental wrong done in the first place when all these objects and items were taken out.
Well, it just sounds like, so interesting that the early crimes are somehow more legitimate now than these others. But, Deborah, I am interested in the approach of how do you basically drain the swamp of the financial ecosystem where these products find buyers, that there is a marketplace out there. And if you succeed, if your coalition succeeds over time, do you worry that those items then become so hot, so toxic to own, and worthless in a way, actually of negative value given the fact that they were looted, that they'll be destroyed? I'm wondering what the tension is for, because I'm reading, in some of what Amr has put out there, that some of the looting is taken from some of these war sites and held for a decade before they find their way to market. So if you succeed in draining that financial success for those that are looting, do you worry that those artifacts will be destroyed?
I don't see that that's really a big risk in what we're trying to do. What we're trying to do is just make it more difficult. And it's not like, say, with some of the fine pieces of ivory that we saw mass destruction then of ivory. What we are trying to do is to, one, make it so that people would be willing to return them, to make sure that there's a recognition that these things are looted and you should be aware when you're buying. And that's part of the issue. And the Chinese have a great saying, scare the chicken to kill the monkeys. I mean, the other way around. Kill the chicken to scare the monkeys. And to go after and make one big example. In the case of Michael Steinhardt and the fact that they've gone and banned him from life for collecting, that sends a very strong signal to the collecting community in New York that they need to be aware of what they're doing. Mm. One of the other things that we have really focused on, too, is creating legal bases for the ability to engage in the legal trade. So, for example, with Egypt has now negotiated a cultural memorandum of understanding with the United States, and the basis is this 1970 convention. But what they have agreed with the U.S. is that certain types of their antiquities now cannot be exported to the United States unless the person purchasing them has an import permit. And in this case, it shifts the burden of proof. So in the case of the Met, for example, before this agreement, the Met would have to prove that, Egypt would have to prove that the item was looted. Now the Met has to prove that the item is legitimate coming in.
Interesting. Now, just before I go back to Amr, but I'm interested in this Museum of the Bible here in Washington, D.C., basically set up and established by Stephen Green, who also was the Hobby Lobby. Hobby Lobby had a decision against it, also for trading in artifacts, which, looted artifacts, and had to return many of these. How did the Museum of the Bible get on the wrong side of this racket?
Well, I think in the case of the Hobby Lobby issue and the Museum of the Bible, it was perhaps over-enthusiasm, and they were going out and dealing with dealers and others who were providing them with very bad advice. They had gotten legal advice saying not to go ahead with some of these purchases from one of the top cultural property lawyers, and they still went ahead with it anyway. And they've been fined $3 million. They had to return a lot of the items that they had, but they had also donated a number of their collection to the Museum of the Bible. So the Museum of the Bible has now brought in experts to go through all of their collection. They found that every one of the Dead Sea Scrolls that they had purchased actually were fake, which is one of the other issues in the market here. You never really know if you're buying something that's been looted or potentially fake. And they've had to return a number of their items, including a tablet that they've had to return to Iraq.
Amr, one of the things that I talked about earlier is this antiquities trafficking and heritage anthropology research project. You and your colleagues are essentially watching social media. And I'd like our audience to know, you know, where are these items showing up in social media? You did a project on Facebook. Is Facebook cooperating, or are they turning a blind eye to this trafficking that's going on? What are some of the other platforms where you see essentially the market for stolen and looted antiquities?
Right. So my colleague Katie Poole and myself, and Katie actually used to work with Deborah at the Antiquities Coalition when we first met. And so we started looking at social media, because we noticed from around 2013 onwards, as social media and as Facebook was becoming extremely popular in, say, areas like the MENA region, the Middle East, that is, and more specifically those conflict zones like Syria, like Libya, like Yemen, we noticed that these artifacts that we knew were being looted were suddenly starting to show up on social media, on Facebook. And as we dug in more and more into that, and really Katie gets the biggest share of the credit here for doing this, we noticed that there were these groups that were forming. And part of the algorithm of how Facebook works essentially encourages people to join groups, invites you, introduces. So once it notices, once the algorithm notices that you're interested in something, it then kind of opens up more and more to it. So what happened then is that, if you think of it this way, the same tools, the same sort of features on Facebook that you and I might use to share a photo of ourselves, or to share what we did this morning, or who we met with, becomes the perfect toolkit for a would-be trafficker or looter to basically put their wares at. And most critically here is it became the great equalizer, because it removed the most single important bottleneck. That is when the item comes out of the ground, and then how do you bring it out? How do you show it to potential buyers, and more critically, buyers who pay real money? The fact that that bottleneck, that intermediary, is now gone, because then you can take this item, put it on online and basically in these groups, and suddenly everybody can see it, was a huge game changer. We track right now over 330 groups on Facebook, and in excess of 2.5 million people.
Right.
Not all of them obviously active, but they're there in these groups. And that's an incredible change. And of course, Facebook do not help us. They don't work. They refuse to acknowledge, even that they had a problem until very recently, when we finally got them in 2020 to change the
I appreciate that. Thank you. Let me just ask Deborah real quick in our last 30 seconds here. What else do you need to change by way of law? Just 30 seconds, U.S. law, international law. What else would help you in your cause?
Well, one of the things is for countries to extend the laws for money laundering to include the trade in antiquities, to include the art and antiquities market, which is the largest unregulated or self-regulated market in the world today.
Well, fascinating. Well, Deborah Lehr, founder of the Antiquities Coalition, and Amr Al-Azam, professor of Middle East history and anthropology, thank you so much for being with us today. Fascinating conversation. I've been wanting to have this conversation for a year. Very glad we've done it now. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So what's the bottom line? Stealing and trafficking in other people's cultural past and treasures is a huge multi-billion dollar industry. Western museums and private collections are just chock full of antiquities taken during wars and occupations and other acts of imperialism and colonialism. Individuals were the original looters, and now they are criminal syndicates. And they use big social media platforms like Facebook and eBay to sell these priceless items that encase our history. Buyers are out there fueling this criminal racket, and we, all of us, that means you, that means me, are the victims. As my guest said today, we need more awareness of this, and only networks of those who care can protect our history, culture, and past. I care, and you should too. And that's the bottom line.